In 2022, Wisconsin saw a record-setting increase in domestic violence-related suicides and homicides, with an increase of 20% compared to the previous year. That's according to a report from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We'll talk with a domestic violence and policy researcher about why Wisconsin's problem with domestic violence is getting worse and what we can do to improve. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work with victims of domestic violence? Do you know how to spot the signs? Do you know of any local or national resources for victims? If you have some words of support for people experiencing domestic violence, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Marielle Barnes is an assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Marielle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about domestic violence-related deaths, what does that include?
So it captures a number of different things. So it will capture deaths that occurred between victims and perpetrators who were partners or spouses or former partners or spouses. It also captures adults who had children in common and there was a domestic violence situation there. Sometimes it will also capture a child's death that's happened in the context of a domestic violence situation, or even death that's occurred between an adult child and a parent or a grandparent.
So it's a range of deaths that we're talking about. Why do you think that domestic violence-related deaths spiked last year? What played into that?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a number of different factors that have played into this. So the first one is the prevalence of firearms, most definitely. So firearms were the most common weapon used in these domestic violence homicides. Almost 90% of these deaths involved a firearm. And so that definitely exacerbates things. The other big reason that this is happening, I think, is because there's decreasing support for victims of violence and sexual violence. A lot of Wisconsin organizations are facing significant cuts to the point where when I'm talking to different domestic violence organizations, they're saying that they're going to have to close their shelters or they can't afford to have their hotlines open 24/7, which is really important. And then the third reason I would say is that there's really a shortage of affordable housing right now in Wisconsin, and that makes it very difficult for victims of violence to leave situations and find somewhere to live away from that violence and away from that abuse.
You mentioned the funding piece, and I'm curious about that, Marielle. Is that a local, a county, a state, or a federal funding issue? Is it a combination of factors? Where is the money going away?
Yeah. So, a lot of the funding a lot of organizations get funding from what we call VOCA, which is the violence legislation. And so that is actually decreasing 70%. So Wisconsin will see a 70% cut in federal funding to domestic violence and sexual assault services. This year, or this coming year, they're anticipating getting $13.5 million in funding. But last year, it was $44.5 million. So that's a significant cut. And that's a lot of organizations fund a lot of services from that money.
I have to say that among other U.S. states, Wisconsin sits in the middle of the rankings for rates of domestic violence. So why is our death rate so high?
Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's the prevalence of firearms and it's the affordable housing issue. That's a huge problem. To put this in perspective, in the same period last year, Minnesota only had 24 people die as a result of domestic violence. And I would say that those two states are fairly comparable, right? We're mm-hmm. both Midwestern states, both Northern. But Wisconsin is much, much worse.
Well, let's delve into that a little bit. Are there any restrictions in Wisconsin on gun ownership for people convicted of a domestic violence related crime right now?
I'm not 100% on that. There is a case going up to the Supreme Court right now about whether people who have been convicted of domestic violence can own a firearm. I can tell you that research shows that domestic violence homicides decrease 7% in states that actually do pass laws that confiscate firearms from individuals who have a restraining order. But that's not in Wisconsin, as far as I am aware.
Marielle Barnes is with us today to discuss the increase in domestic violence-related deaths in Wisconsin, and there's plenty of time for your calls and thoughts on this difficult issue. 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Carry, which is a Second Amendment rights advocacy group, suggested that the state should allow people who are awarded a restraining order to be able to get that temporary concealed carry permit. Do you think that would mitigate the number of domestic violence-related deaths in the state? What impact did that have?
I don't think it would mitigate it. I think it would make it more prevalent. The risk of death goes up 5 times when a firearm is in the household. It's just so much easier when people are angry and when emotions are high to commit an action that you would not without having that firearm present. So I think having the firearm in the household and having concealed carry laws would increase deaths related to domestic violence.
Do you think it would have the opposite effect from what they intend? Mm-hmm. You also talked about affordable housing, and boy, this is in the headlines all over the place. No matter what community you're mm-hmm. in, you hear about the housing affordability crisis, not enough housing, not enough affordable housing. Talk a little bit about the connection there. What's the connection between affordable housing and domestic violence deaths?
Mm-hmm. So when you're in a situation of domestic violence, obviously you need somewhere to go. And usually that can be a domestic violence shelter. It can be family or friends. It can be like alternative people that you know, but ultimately, like, you cannot leave that situation unless you have a permanent place to live and a safe place to live. And what we're seeing is that rents are extremely high right now. Interest rates are very, very high, and it makes it hard to buy a home. And there's just a lack of affordable housing stock. So if you have no long-term solution about where you're going to stay, like, you might not leave the situation that you're currently in because you just don't know where you're going to live, or you don't know where your kids are. You know, you can put a roof over your kid's head and where they're going to go to school and that kind of thing. And this is occurring in both rural areas that have a shortage of housing stock, but it's also in urban areas. So in Madison and Milwaukee that really need extra or need more housing in general. And also it's affordable, but also quality housing. Right. So it's houses that are safe and secure for people to live in, essentially.
Well, we've talked about affordable housing and we've talked about the funding gap and we've talked about gun policy. Aside from those things, and I know that's a lot, but what can be done to reduce the number of domestic violence related deaths in Wisconsin? What other solutions might be out there that you and other advocates and advocates are looking at as potential game changers?
Mm-hmm. So obviously controlling firearms or restricting firearms to people who are responsible with them and don't have domestic violence convictions, mm-hmm. Affordable housing, but also, I guess, raising awareness is really, really important. So a lot of people who are experiencing domestic abuse and domestic violence often don't realize that they're experiencing that. We often think of domestic violence as physical or sexual violence against people, but there's a whole range of other things that it can include. So it can include financial abuse, right? So maybe your partner is opening up credit cards in your name and running up debt. So you can't, you don't have a good credit score. And when people do a credit background check on you, you can't get a house, right? Mm-hmm. Or your landlord doesn't want to rent to you. Or maybe they are controlling how much money you have every week. It's also people being, you know, domestic violence also includes like stalking. So I have talked to victims who have said that their partners send them flowers as an apology And people say, oh, that's very nice of them. But what the victims actually want is no contact at all. And so realizing that all of these different forms of violence exist, and realizing when you are in a relationship like that and recognizing those kind of red flags are really, really important, I think, for getting people out of those relationships.
I've heard from survivors of domestic violence that getting a restraining order is kind of an arduous process. I was a little surprised by that. What they have to go through to get a restraining order. Sometimes there's costs involved. Is that process something that could be streamlined? Would that help? And do restraining orders help at all?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think the process is more onerous than it has to be. It is improving, particularly as awareness through the judiciary of domestic violence and what domestic violence includes improves. I definitely think we could do more, though, to make that an easier process. In terms of whether restraining orders help, the results are mixed on that. If an abuser is very, very motivated, it can be very difficult to dissuade them, is what I will say. But also, a restraining order or an order of protection means they cannot approach you. So there is, if your abuser does approach you, there are legal recourses to breaking that order.
We're talking with Marielle Barnes, assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, about why domestic violence-related deaths are becoming more frequent in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share, have you or someone you know escaped a domestic violence situation? What helped you leave? And what kind of support systems were there for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Mario Barnes, assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We are talking about the spike in domestic violence-related deaths we've seen in Wisconsin over the last year and what we can do to prevent them. We want to hear what you think. 800-642-1234. Do you have ideas for protections you think that would help for survivors of domestic abuse? What restrictions do you think we should place on perpetrators? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Marielle, what are some of the signs of a potentially abusive partner that people should be watching for?
Mm-hmm. There's a number of different signs that you can think about. So the first one is obviously any kind of threat that someone would make against you. So if someone says like they're going to kill you, you should take that very seriously. Another sign is if you've ever been strangled by a partner before. We know that the odds of a homicide or dying at the hands of a partner increase sevenfold if you've previously been strangled. And oftentimes when that happens, the consequences of having someone's hands around your throat, which is a particularly sensitive area, don't emerge potentially for days. And so that's something when I hear someone has been strangled, I'm always very concerned about them. And I always recommend that they go to see a doctor to be checked out and let the doctor know what is going on, because they can refer you to services. Other things, so oftentimes abusers will love bomb people, is what we call it.
What does that mean? Love bomb. I don't think I've heard that before.
Mm-hmm. That means where they're very attentive to you. They will provide, they will give you presents. They will be on their best behavior. And then that often goes on for a period of days or a couple of weeks. And then all of a sudden, they will be violent or abusive or harassing you. And then all of a sudden, once they realize what they've done, they're very apologetic. They go back to being a very loving and caring kind of partner. But that loving and caringness does not outweigh the violence and abusive that they commit against people. So that would be something, if you think they're in this kind of cycle of like abuse and violence and then love, like those two things are not balancing each other out, mm-hmm. that can potentially be an abusive relationship as well.
We have Michelle with us now from Mequon. Michelle, hi.
Hi. So my 10 years since, or should I say saga, was I used to go to group and it was a little bit too quiet when I told my story. So I kind of felt ashamed. I was in a 10-year relationship that at the very end, before we went to court in like 2016, he tried to strangle me. And I had a list of things for the restraining order. And we went to court and he openly admitted in court that he tried to strangle me, but I could not use it against him because that was 2016 ago, as it reads in the transcript. I feel there should be some kind of tougher laws because I was blatantly told that basically, even though he said that under oath, I would not be able to probably make anything stick. Mm-hmm. And I kind of gave up on the idea of making it stick, but the judge did offer me, in all fairness, a 10-year restraining order. He said, would you like a 4 or a 10-year restraining order?
So, you got the restraining order, but you feel like there just weren't any real punishments for your partner then?
I mean, I feel like he's suffering because he had a social worker, so then he wasn't able to see his kids either.
Okay. Michelle, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate the call. What do you think about that, Marielle? I mean, do punishments need to be stronger? Would that help?
Potentially. So one of the things I often hear from victims is, you know, I knew where my partner was. And I've had a number of different victims say, like, if they're in jail, I know where they are, and that makes me feel safe. But on the other hand, we have to also think about kind of the carceral justice system and how that works. And so it's really difficult to balance like different concerns here. I do hear a lot from victims that they often don't feel believed by the justice system as well. And they feel like they feel shame, and they feel like they go through that process and then nothing comes of it. And so that we can definitely improve that, I think, a lot.
We have Maddie with us now. Maddie is calling from South Central Wisconsin. Maddie, thanks for calling.
Hi. So I just wanted to speak to some of the frustrations I've had myself within this process in Madison. So when you file a restraint, and I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last person, so I'm not sure if I'm repeating anything, but when you file a restraining order, you actually have to go to court with the person. I mean, they said typically they don't show up.
Oh, yeah, and you have to face them right there. Mm-hmm.
Yes, this person I thought would show up, which was scary, but I was willing to still do it. I said, make sure you call me because I'm in the process of moving and et cetera. They assured me they would call me about the court date. And then instead they emailed me like 36 hours ahead of time. Okay. And so I missed it. And, then you have to start all back over. And it really is, it's like a horribly traumatic experience because you have to rewrite everything that happened, why you're actually like, it's just, it's a lot of stress, and it is a lot of strings to pull to even make it happen in the first place. And I just don't understand why you have to argue against somebody else in court. And they were like, and then you might be up for defamation.
Okay. You know, and Maddie, thank you so much for calling. Marielle, when we hear Maddie talk about her experience and that frustration, is that something that's very common, that that knowing that you have to go to court and face the person who is your abuser, how deterring is that for victims?
That's very deterring. And that's super common that we hear, in that the burden is placed on the victim to prove that they have been a victim of domestic violence. And it's, they have to jump through hoops all the time. And as Maddie was saying, like, you know, if you miss a step or you miss a date, you have to restart the whole process again, which is a problem. And facing your abuser is not an easy task. I've heard stories of like abusers like tapping a lighter on the table and like you would fiddle with a pen kind of thing. And it seems like a very innocuous gesture until you find out that that particular abuser had threatened to douse their partner in gasoline and light them on fire. And so facing your abuser, even in a court, is very, very intimidating. And we do not make it easy for people to do that and to seek recourse and to seek protect orders of protection and things like that.
In our final 30, 45 seconds, how might listeners get involved in helping survivors of domestic abuse?
Mm-hmm. So there's always organizations throughout Wisconsin that are providing support, domestic violence organizations. Many of them ask for volunteers to help out. A lot of them have regular fundraising efforts to provide help to survivors so they can provide so they can keep the hotline open, the shelter open, mm-hmm. so they can help survivors get into housing or buy a car or pay for moving expenses. So I would definitely encourage people to look at their local organizations and reach.
Mario, thank you so much for joining us today, Assistant Professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Appreciate you being with us.